I hope everyone's doing well this afternoon. So I get to handle the topic that people probably have heard the least of, metabolomics, or metabolomics as I've been calling it for years. It's an interesting story of how I got interested in this. Basically, Dan Hahn, who's present here and one of our speakers today, he taught me how to do lipidomics before he ran off to Florida. And so I learned how to use a gas chromatograph, and I did some interesting work with fatty acids. And then one day I come into work, and Dave's there with a big, Dave Denlinger is the person I work for. He has a big, bright smile on his face, and he's like, "Well, Rob, can you do this?" And he hands me this paper. And it was one of the seminal works in metabolomics in Europe. And so I got into it, and next thing you know, I'm publishing a couple papers, and now I'm here before you to talk about it. So, where does metabolomics fit in the big picture? And as I titled it, it's a quick snapshot of the biochemical landscape. I will show you. So we're all familiar with genomics. That was something that we've heard about since the 80s. And of course, as you go through the central dogma of molecular biology, things to move to RNA, which is transcriptomics, and proteins, which is proteomics, and then right here at the end are these substrates and products. And that is where metabolomics comes in. And so I study basically the endpoint of the central dogma of molecular biology. Okay, to give you a little brief history of metabolomics, and trust me, it is brief. biochemists have been doing metabolomics for many, many years, since 1910, basically. But it wasn't until high-resolution chromatography was invented in the late 1960s that really this field could take off, because face it, on a TLC plate, you're not going to get hundreds and hundreds of metabolites and be able to quantify them very well. So in 1970, Arthur Robinson was doing urinalysis of lots of vitamin B6 treated human beings, and he noticed that there were some differences from one sample to the next. And it wasn't just individual variation. He noticed there were some differences that seemed to be related to disease. And so this whole idea of taking the entire metabolome and looking at and studying from one treatment to another was born really of this. And him and a man named Pauling published their first paper a year later in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And really, there it kind of sat. No one really took up the idea, the technique, and it just sort of foundered for a while. And one paper written by Oliver, later on, maybe, 17 years later, where he coins the term metabolome. And that got the Max Planck Institute interested in this, and this gentleman named Will Mitzer started writing this whole series of review papers where he talks about metabolomics. And it really ignited a lot of fires with a lot of scientists. And so next thing you know, a metabolomics society is formed, and people are doing projects all over the country. And to be quite honest, they're actually thinking about using this particular technique to study human disease. Because out of Canada recently, they've come up with this human metabolome project. And basically with this, what they're doing is they're creating databases by which to clinically test people for certain diseases. Now, it's not being used in the clinic yet, but it's probably just a few years away. So what exactly does a metabolomic experiment have as its components? Well, for one, you have to have very little metabolite bias when you're sampling. You can't just target one particular kind of metabolite. You can't say, well, I want intermediates of the Krebs cycle, or, oh, I just want amino acids. You want to grab as much stuff as you can. Which is really interesting about it, though, is that that's impossible. You cannot pull every single small molecule out. So usually you get some kind of solvent system where you have a polar and a nonpolar group. And usually, us people that do metabolomics, we stick with the polar group. They're very, very simple compounds compared to these large lipids that are very hard to identify. Next is you must measure all your metabolites simultaneously. And usually that's done with a machine where you run them all through and then the chromatography separates them all. And then, of course, at the end you have some kind of detector. And then at the end, you must use multivariate statistics to establish your relationships. So you can run a series of ANOVAs on all this stuff. You know, if you have 75 different metabolites and you want to run ANOVAs on them, that's fine. But really, the idea is to get a vector for your particular biological condition, and to get that on some kind of a quadrant system so you can see differences between vectors. And I'll show you how that works. Mostly what we use is principal components analysis to get this, and I'll get into explaining that a little bit later. Okay, so we have this idea that you got to measure a lot of metabolites at the same time. And we have a lot of instruments that can do that. For one, gas chromatography is standardly used. It's considered the gold standard. It's nice because you get a whole lot of peaks. And usually with gas chromatography, it's hooked up to some kind of system that goes with a library, and you can get pretty good identification at the end. The only problem with it is most gas chromatography, you can't really run polar compounds through, you'll ruin your machine. So you have to derivatize your compounds in order for them to show up and for them to not ruin your machine. And that will chemically alter a lot of your metabolites and can be a confounding factor. You can also use HPLC, but that has a much lower resolution, but there's no derivatization involved. But resolution is really kind of so low that it's not really that easy to work with, and a lot of these machines, unfortunately, aren't hooked up to the newest fangled libraries. And then there's a new technique that's being used, capillary electrophoresis, and to be quite honest, I don't know a whole lot about the technique. I do know that what they say is that it has much better resolution as HPLC, and you don't need to derivatize on it, so that might be the best of both worlds. Okay, so for detection methods, mass spectrometry is the easiest to go with. Very good identifications. There's lots of libraries to hook up to, so you can identify things easy without having to hire yourself a chemist who knows what every compound is by just a basic number. And then there's also NMR, which is not near as sensitive, but also it's not destructive. So if you find a metabolite that is altered, you can actually pull it out of the machine and use it later, which is rather interesting. Okay, so I really think that just talking about metabolomics in the general sense is not really all that interesting. So what I'll do is I'll tell you the work that I've done, and so you can kind of see how this technique comes together. So the first study was on an insect that we've already discussed today, Sarcophaga crassipalpus, the flesh fly. This is an excellent model for diapause and for cold hardiness. So I wanted to study two things. I wanted to study rapid cold hardening, and I wanted to study diapause. For rapid cold hardening, that may be a process you're not familiar with. Basically, if you take a fly at normal room temperature and you stick it at a temperature that's below zero, that's pretty severe, like negative 10, and take them back out again, they will die. But you take the same flies, and if you put them at a mild cool temperature, like 0 degrees for an hour, 2 hours, and then you put them under the same exposure at minus 10, they survive. So we call that whole process at 0 degrees rapid cold hardening. And why does rapid cold hardening occur? The only thing that we know really so far is that certain polyols come up, and at this point, it was just glycerol. There's also some membrane restructuring, but that's not the topic today. And here's a little survival graph. You can see that non-rapid cold hardened die pretty quickly, and the ones that are rapid cold hardened do survive much better. Also, I wanted to study diapause. Dan has done a great job of explaining some of the diapause for the flesh fly, so I'm not going to get into it too deeply, but it is basically induced by photoperiod and enhanced by low temperature. Lasts for about 80 days, and there's this interesting cycle of oxygen consumption that occurs. Also, they're extremely cold hardy in this state, whereas the fly can only survive a couple hours at negative 10 degrees, now the fly can survive for several days. We know that there's upregulated heat shock transcripts there, there's a little bit of glycerol increase, there's an alanine increase, and there's nothing else that was basically known before I got into this topic. For the protocol, that's the beauty of metabolomics, or metabolomics. It is very easy. All you need is to have your samples here, and for here I use diapausing or rapidly cold hardened pupae, and I use non-diapausing pupae as a control for the diapausers, and I use red-eye ferrate adults as the control for the rapidly cold hardened pupae, and that's because rapid cold hardening is the strongest during that particular life stage. And you grind them up in a glass homogenizer, usually with a two-phase extraction method. And believe it or not, I use the Bly and Dyer method that Dan Hahn taught me a long time ago. And the reason why is it uses both water and methanol for the polar part. So it's more likely to pull out more metabolites. I also use a large amount of chloroform in there as well, not only to precipitate out the protein, but to pull out all those nasty fats that get in the way. And then I take the aqueous layer. So I'm throwing out all the fats, but trust me, there is a whole branch of metabolomics where you study the lipids. The only problem is the identifications aren't that good for it, and I really wanted to get good, meaningful data for this first study, so I stuck with the aqueous layer. Then you double derivatize. First, you methoxymate them, then you trimethylciliate them. And really, that's just taking all of the polar active groups and making them look like the inside of a column so they don't mess it up very much. They also produce much, much sharper peaks under those conditions. Then I analyzed the GCMS. I used a trace Finnegan machine. And then you quantify the metabolites and compare your treatments. And while we're discussing comparing treatments, there are three terms that people use in metabolomics. There's metabolomics, which is really an all-encompassing term that really means getting everything, getting all the lipids, getting all the amino acids, getting all the intermediate metabolites. And then that's really something that no one attains. And then there's metabonomics or metabonomics, like economics. That's where you actually study the differences from one treatment to another treatment. So really when I'm discussing metabolomics in this, I'm really discussing metabonomics, but they're often used interchangeably. And last, there's metabolic profiling. What's nice about metabolic profiling is you don't have to identify anything. All you really have to do is get your chromatograph and overlay it over another chromatograph and see that there are differences between them. And you can actually database the shape of a chromatograph and call that one treatment and then the shape of another. And then in the future, if you get a chromatograph that unknown chromatograph, you can actually match it to one of those kinds of treatments. So that's metabolic profiling. So I do metabonomics, to be quite honest. But it's really hard to say. All right, so this is a standard segment of derivatized metabolome here. You can see I have a few compounds that are identified, and you can tell that I have a whole bunch of compounds that are not identified. This is one of the major problems with metabolomics, is the fact that only about half of your peaks, or some most times actually less than half of your peaks, are identifiable. And you always come back and you're like, what are these other peaks, you know? But unfortunately, without any identification, I can't really do much with them biologically. All I can do is score them. Okay, so out of 175 peaks, these are all the ones that were identifiable. And as you can see, we've got a nice cross-section of the metabolome here. A number of amino acids, numbers of sugars and polyols, a few metabolic intermediates, not all of them, but enough to look into Krebs cycle and look into glycolysis a little bit. And then a number of small molecules here, free amine, free phosphate, free sulfate, and then a bunch of other metabolites that most of them I really couldn't put in a specific pathway or figure out what the heck they were doing in the system. All right, so after you've gotten all these identified and scored up, then you want to do that multivariate analysis. Okay, and so we use principal component analysis. That's really all I've ever seen in the literature. I wonder if they use other methods, but this seems to be pretty standardized. If you don't understand principal components analysis, that's okay, I barely understand it myself. But really, the whole idea is to take this large amount of data and reduce it to very, very simple factors, an X coordinate, a Y coordinate. And the way this works is, if you can imagine, well actually it's very hard to imagine, but if you can imagine a system with 75 dimensions for 75 metabolites, what this does is it finds the two dimensions or two or three dimensions that seem to fit best and be the most meaningful, and then it takes these two and it turns the orthogonal in such a way to where the most meaningful relationship can be established between two groups. So here we have rapidly cold hardened conditions here, and we have your control conditions here. And as you can see, there's no overlap between the principal component 1 and the principal component 2 on this graph. Now, what principal component 1 really is it's the angle of the orthogonal that gives you the most variation. And then the PC2 is the one that gives you the next most variation. So we're still looking for the most meaningful relationships here. And as you can see, they are separated from each other. And what I've done is I've circumscribed these areas. You can also take these points and just take the X and Y coordinates and average them. And when you do that, you get a far less stringent method there. I like to use the full circumscribe because it kind of shows that these conditions are completely different from each other. Also, you see the non-diapause and the diapause showed up much the same way. Now, you cannot compare one graph to the other because remember, the orthogonal changes depending on your treatments. And then, of course, even though I discussed not using a bunch of ANOVAs, I went ahead and did it anyway, just to take a look at which individual metabolites were meaningful. And here you could see of the major metabolites, we had a great increase in alanine. Alanine is a really interesting compound because just about every cold study I've ever seen where they actually study the amino acids, alanine goes up in response to cold or anticipation of the cold. Yet I see very few hypotheses in the literature on this. And this is just another example of alanine coming up, and I believe that Dr. Chippendale even had this occur with him on the 80s with his moth. I really think that this should be a meaningful thing since it's seen in insect after insect. Also, you can see the ones that are in blue are upregulated, the ones in red are downregulated. We have a number of other compounds here. I'd like to point out the glycerol and the sorbitol. Glycerol was already known in the literature to be upregulated, and you can see here it's higher in concentration. Sorbitol as well, which I thought was interesting because it wasn't previously mentioned in the literature. So it looks like we might have a multiple polyol system here. Let's see, and for diapause, we have a reduction of isocitrate, which is the very first step in the Krebs cycle. I think that's rather interesting as well. A great increase of pyruvate at the same time. So it looks like that the pyruvate is building up, the isocitrate is dropping. It almost seems like everything is building up at the back end of glycolysis and not entering into the Krebs cycle. So I thought that was also interesting as well. You also have an increase in glycerol here, but a reduction in sorbitol, and then a number of other changes in amino acids that occur. Now this is fun, but it's a little confusing to describe it that way. So I like to do things in terms of Venn diagrams. So here we have rapid cold hardening and diapause, and you can see that there are four common metabolites that are upregulated for both: alanine, glycerol, glucose, and pyruvate. As we know, glycerol has already been mentioned in literature both for rapid cold hardening and for diapause, no big deal there. Alanine is up as well, but glucose and pyruvate are rather interesting. Glucose has been shown to be recruited at the beginning of rapid cold hardening, at least at the enzymatic level. So this is somewhat explainable, but this pyruvate I found to be rather interesting. Also, you can see that rapid cold hardening brings up the sorbitol, drops it down here. You see a number of amino acids are reduced for diapause, but leucine seems to be increased. There is no down-regulated comparison between rapid cold hardening and diapause. So this is really the best way to describe meaningful relationships when it comes to these metabolomics experiments. Much like Dan, I also like to take a pathway approach as well. And I use a different methodology here. If you could see up here, I use the p equals 0.01 for my cutoff. The reason why I do this is because when you're making a lot of comparisons like this, the likelihood for type 1 error goes up dramatically, and so you have to have some way to correct this. I did it arbitrarily by bringing it to 0.01. However, there are better methods of doing that, and I'll show that on the second experiment here. Okay, so coming back to this, everything that is boldly highlighted here is significant to the level of 0.01. Everything that is not boldly highlighted, just kind of a thin circle, is significant to 0.05. So much like Dan, I wanted to see what was really significant, and then all the things that were almost there. That way, whole pathways could be lit up. And as you can see, we've got an increase in pyruvate and alanine here and cystathionine. There seemed to be just a lot of increase in this area. The only problem is I'm kind of at a loss for explaining how this is meaningful for survival. However, over here on this side, you see glycerol. This is the glycerol catabolism pathway, and you can see I have an increase in fructose 6-phosphate, the NADs go up, and glycerol 3-phosphate goes up, and glycerol goes up greatly. So this is a wonderful pathway to target for future analysis. And that is really one of the main thrusts of metabolomics, or any omics for that matter. We do a lot of work on this with fancy statistics and all, but in the end, none of us who do this kind of work are absolutely sure of our results. We like doing it, and it really looks neat for us, but in the end, we are always going to end up either A, doing a target analysis, or B, we're going to end up doing some kind of really, really stringent statistical technique that knocks out all the noise. Only under those circumstances can we find real confidence in what we're doing. And what I found really, really interesting, and to be quite honest, the data that Dan presented today, this is really the first time I've ever seen it. So I've got a whole lot more to say about the slide and not enough time to think of it to say it. But what I found with diapause was that all the glycolytic compounds or closely related glycolytic compounds were greatly increased for diapause. However, over down in the Krebs cycle, I found a lot of tremendously decreased compounds. And ones that branch sort of off the side of it as well. So it kind of showed me a nice hypothesis that you have shut down the Krebs cycle during diapause, but glycolysis remains active. And of course, we saw today with Dan's data that he's showing much the same thing. And I cannot tell you how happy I am when there's an independent analysis that shows much the same thing that mine does, yes. So from the Crassapalpa study, we conclude that metabolomics is effective. Also, that rapid co-hardening and diapause did alter the metabolome from control. We saw that from the PCA analysis. And the increased metabolites, in most cases, have been either A, observed in other species, or have a potential to contribute to cold survival through a variety of mechanisms that are found elsewhere in the literature. Also, this highlighted a number of putative biochemical pathways and enzymes to target for further analysis, because omics is a hypothesis-generating tool more than anything. And the results of the experiments can be coupled with data from other omics experiments, as you witnessed today with Dan's study, to show that much of these processes, much of these processes basically can be solidified with more than one omics experiment. Okay, so for the second study I wanted to do was Belgica Antarctica. This study here was, this particular insect is the most southerly distributed insect in the world. This guy is a real survivor. And this is the adult male here. It is a wingless insect that you find in Antarctica. But in order to go to Antarctica, you definitely have to tolerate some difficult conditions. These guys have a 2-year life cycle with no diapause. They overwinter in ice and snow, and they're a freeze-tolerant species. They also tolerate a wide range of salinity and pH, mostly because they have to deal with the constant ocean coming in and sweeping over their substrate and coming back out again. And they survive dehydration to 50% of its original body weight, which is a really, really good survival rate for that level of dehydration. They could survive for 2 to 4 weeks in anoxic conditions. And as you can probably predict, they continuously produce heat shock proteins and other antioxidant enzymes. That's one of the reasons they have such a good survival. But I wanted to see what inimical conditions did to these guys at a metabolic level. So we got these intrepid explorers to go down to Antarctica. A couple members here, this is Josh Benoit, and this is Giancarlo Lopez Martinez from my lab. And they went down to Palmer Station, and they got lots and lots of Belgica larvae. These little guys are like little purple hares, is what they look like. They're very, very small. But they came back with lots of soil and maybe tens of thousands of individuals. And then we kept them in a walk-in refrigerator in our laboratory to do the experiments on. Okay, so I wanted to study three things: cold, heat, and desiccation for these guys. So I'm not going to bog you down with any details. We're just going to go straight to Venn diagrams on this. As you can see, all the upregulated metabolites here, there was one commonality with all of them, nonanoic acid, which I found interesting, but I really couldn't explain it all that well. For the cold, which is really what I'm mostly interested in, I'm a cryobiologist. Once again, we have this alanine. It always seems to come up. Urea came up as well. If you remember from Dan's talk, there seemed to be a little discussion about urea coming up for diapause, or at least the potential for that. Also, I had mannitol, urethritol, and glycerol come up. Now we have a 3-component polyol system. And there are a number of other compounds that you could see here that are changed. Succinate and isocitric acid are on the increase here for desiccation and cold. So this is the opposite of what we saw for diapause. As far as downregulation, there really wasn't a whole lot of commonality with downregulation, but the serine and sorbitol seem to always be there for that. I do not know the meaning of a continuous downregulation of sorbitol. That's normally considered a cryoprotectant. Why it would go down while others go up, maybe it's just what particular proteins are affected whenever they get to these those conditions. I really don't have much of an idea on that. But then again, I don't really spend too much time discussing downregulated stuff. It's not as sexy, as they say. This is the principal components analysis. You can see the control is distributed up here. Heat had a very wide distribution. It's the reason why, I think at least, is these insects cannot survive 15 degrees for very long or 20 degrees centigrade for very long. These guys die at normal room temperature. And it makes me wonder if the application of heat was so disruptive to their metabolism that just caused a tremendous amount of variation. Cold had a very, very tight reaction, and desiccation also had a fairly tight reaction as well, and they're very far separated from the control. These are the compounds that are most responsible for the various principal components. As you can see, alpha-ketoglutarate and glycerol 3-phosphate were used to determine PC1 versus serine, proline, aspartate, glycerol, and sorbitol. That's much how this is. It's more like a ladder or a seesaw. What you have is what these orthogonals are is a comparison of one group of metabolites to another group, so it's always something versus something else. And this is the amount of variation, total variation, that each one of these represented. You can also do hierarchical clustering, And I just wanted to see how some of these were related to each other. As you can see, cold and desiccation are very, very closely related, which coincides with most of what you'll read in the literature. A lot of people who work with desiccation marvel at how much like cold their conditions look like. And most people who work with cold think exactly the opposite. And heat seemed to go in the opposite direction from the untreated controls on this. So basically, heat treatment is just completely different than anything you're going to get for cold or desiccation. So I thought the results of this were fairly interesting as well. And of course, you have to do a little bit of a comparison between the species. I find it interesting that of the two animals that I've studied so far, both of them have multi-polyol systems. If you've done any reading in the cryobiological literature, most of the increase in polyols that's seen is just one compound, and it's a result of targeted analysis. Someone will come up with the hypothesis, hey, is glycerol up? They got a kit. They work with the kit, and they go, hey, it's up, and then they stop. And then they say, well, you know, we found this increase in this polyol, but it wasn't really enough to cause a tremendous amount in survival, so something else must be involved. Well, the great thing about omics is you can cover the whole landscape, so you can find those multiple polyols. There's a reduction in Krebs cycle activity that I saw with Crassipalpus. There's a little bit involved with Belgica. I didn't want to get into that, but the increase of those two particular compounds together has been associated with a reduction in Krebs cycle activity, at least in the literature. They all have movement of alanine and other amino acids, and there's a urea change component to both of them, which I found rather interesting. The contrast seemed to be in the details of the similarities. For one, I gave them different treatments. The levels are a little bit different between the two. Some of them have two polyols coming up. Some of them have three. So there's quite a bit of difference there if you're going to look on a detailed level between the two. That is, differences within the similarities. And last is a study that we've done recently on Urosa salutogenes. This stuff is hot off the presses. I just made this slide before I came up. I just wanted to show the raw data for a metabolomics experiment to show you how you can even see changes that occur over time in one organism. So we did a study on the goldenrod gall fly where we were just tracking the polyols through the year. And we only have a couple months worth of data, but this is pretty stark. So this is a little movie I made. And that is the beginning slide. And you can see this is glycerol and this is sorbitol. And these are taken at two-week intervals. And you can see, just on the raw data, how these two polyols greatly increase just in a few weeks' time. What's also neat about this is there's another number of other compounds that you can see on there that make some changes as well, some of them quite directional. The only problem about it is these data are so hot off the presses, I don't have identifications for all these compounds yet. So, but the ones I could definitely point out are these two as well. This one here is proline. As you can see, proline is doing something kind of fun there. But that's really the power of this kind of technique. You just grind something, you run a couple of chemical reactions on it, you throw it into a machine, you get your chromatograph out, and if your machine is a new one, like the ones they usually have, it does all the integration for you, it does all the identification for you. All you do is just hang out there as an eager beaver waiting for the data to spit out, and then you can quickly do an analysis with this. It is cost effective, it is fast, and it generates lots of hypotheses. Anyway, I'd like to thank, first and foremost, David Denlinger. He was my mentor during my graduate studies, and he's also my postdoctoral advisor. Joshua Benoit and Giancarlo, as I had mentioned before, who both went out and got, and Michael Anitsky and Rick Lee, they all went out and got the Belgica. There are some intellectual contributors not listed on any of my papers: Joan Reinhart, John Wenzel, Dan Hahn, who I just cannot thank enough for opening the world of GCMS to me, and Scott Hayward. And I had a couple of technical contributors, had Amelia Brown, who was a work study, who worked very, very hard to grind up all the insects and get everything ready while I was running off doing other things, and Richard Sessler, who was a wonderful technician at our core facility, who basically kept the machine running in good order while I did everything. And of course, NSF for their kind contributions, and the OARDC and the OSU for my fellowships. Anyway, I'd be glad to entertain questions. Yes, sir.
If you
If it can't produce polyols and it runs across a condition in which basically it cannot survive normally without inducing them, you bet these guys will most likely die. That's something that we love writing into grants, where we say, well, if we can stop these guys from surviving the winter, it's good biocontrol and all. I think that some of these compounds can be, you can come up with a target for them, but that's another thing that metabolomics is powerful of. You can also find other methods as well. If you can't target a particular enzyme, you might find a number of systems that contribute to survival and just target one that you know you already have a good agent for. Sir? Yeah, you're very right about that. I will be the first person to admit that I'm not the most technically savvy of scientists. I've got kind of butterfingers when it comes to working with really, really small material. So most of my work is done on whole body, but you will get far more meaningful data, most likely, out of individual tissues because the reduced variation. Also, the reduced number of metabolites helps as well. If you've done a lot of work on a GCMS, the size of your peaks determines a lot what your retention time is. If you have a very, very large peak that shows up, it'll actually push the peaks beyond it a little further along, and your machine may not pick it up as well. So if you could reduce that variation or eliminate tremendous sources of peaks, like, for example, the crop, that would do a lot towards making these analyses far more accurate.
I have a follow-up on Mike's question.
Yes, sir.
About, for example, just looking at heads.
Heads. Yeah. Exactly. Most of the head work that has been done in the past, for our lab has been looking for hormones or looking for particular brain proteins and all. I didn't really know what to expect, so I went after the whole body on a lot of this stuff. But the heads might very well produce something interesting. There's a lot of shutdown that occurs around the brain and all, especially for the cold survival stuff. That'd be easy to do. A head, a thorax, an abdomen, ventral side, those kind of cuttings I can do very easily. So you get a lot of, Trehalose is a gigantic peak when you're looking at these things. It's really the biggest peak that usually shows up. And if you're doing a hemolymph study, that's where the trehalose is. So, centrifuging these guys, getting rid of the blood might be another way of going to try to eliminate that trehalose peak. The good thing is it shows up on the very end of the chromatograph, so it typically doesn't affect anything in front of it.